We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Red Leg Roundtable. I am Seth Shaner, and I'm very pleased today to be joined by longtime veteran sports writer Hal McCoy. Hal, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on, Seth. Appreciate it.
Well, it's great to talk to you. I want to run through a little bit of your background and then introduce the fact that you were such a part of covering the Reds for so many years. Sorry to date you here, but you were born October 18th, 1940. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Akron, Ohio, in northeastern Ohio. Cleveland Indians fan.
Okay. All right. Well, then you attended Kent State University. Did you play baseball there?
I received a partial scholarship, and I played my freshman year and found out really quickly that I could hit the keys better than I could hit the baseball. So, joined the Daily Kent Stater newspaper, and that's where it all began.
Yeah, and a lot of us learned that even before we could play college baseball. So you're a little bit ahead of me there. You became a Dayton Daily News Reds beat writer in 1973. How did you end up going? Where were you between Kent State and there, and how'd you end up in Dayton?
Well, in 1962, I graduated from Kent State and wanted to be a sports writer. I was sports editor of the Daily Kent Stater. And I had 11 job offers. Back then, there were a lot of jobs to be had. Now it's the other way around.
Right.
But none of them were for sports. New Sentinel as a crime reporter. And then about a week later, Ritter Collette of the Dayton Journal-Herald called me and said they had a sports opening. So I said, I'll be there. And called Fort Wayne and told them I would not be there. They were not very happy.
Yeah,
but I ended up in 1962 joining the Dayton newspaper, and for the next 10 years, I covered everything that you can imagine. I covered golf, I covered the Masters, the PGA, and the Open. I covered auto racing. I covered the Daytona 500, the Indianapolis 500. I covered the Cleveland Browns the last year that. They won a championship in 1964, and I've offered to come back and cover them so they could win the Super Bowl, but they haven't taken me up on it. I covered Bo Schembechler when Ohio, and was very, very fortunate to be able to cover all of those things. And in 1973, my sports editor came to me. He said, we have two openings on the paper. We have the Cincinnati Bengals and the Cincinnati Reds. And since I grew up playing baseball and did go to Kent State and played a little bit, I chose the Reds. And I was always glad I did take the Reds over the Bengals because I was never a very good crime reporter.
Well, how you brought jokes to the table. That's funny. Yeah. And so I guess just to go down a little bit on your bio, you were honored by the Baseball Writers Association of America in 2002 with the J.G. Taylor Spink Award. And certainly the layperson might say you're in the Hall of Fame. And I know technically there's different wings and different things of that museum, but it is, it's a huge deal to have that recognition. I wonder, could you tell me how honored you felt to have that award?
Well, it's the highlight of my career, the highlight of my life, other than my family. I never, ever dreamed anything like that would ever happen. And to have your peers vote you into the Hall of Fame, that's just something that you can't hardly describe it. I know when I was elected, Johnny Bench told me, now when you go to Cooperstown for that 3-day weekend, write down everything that goes on or you'll forget it. Yeah. Well, I didn't take his advice and I didn't. And it went by in a whirlwind, and I'm sure I have forgotten a lot of it, but there was so much that happened that it was just a fantastic weekend.
Well, and I can't compare it, but it does. That reminds me a little of my wedding day. I felt like, you know, it just went so fast, and I don't feel like I was able to talk to anybody. I know I didn't get a piece of cake. It was gone before I got there. Hey, I wanted to tell you before I ask you a little bit about the Reds, I actually met you. You were very helpful to me. I was a college student at Ohio State. And I was an intern at the radio station in Columbus that has the Ohio State football and basketball games as the flagship station. They sent me to Cleveland to cover a Reds-Indians game in 2000. And I met you on the field before the game. And I told you where you asked me where I was from. And I told you, and you had, I believe, a stepson enrolling at Ohio State at the time. And so you actually asked me questions about the campus and things like that. And the next thing I know, you and I are going over and talking to Ken Griffey Sr. and Joe Nuxall in the dugout. We're speaking with Junior. All this stuff that I wouldn't have gotten to do. I would have just been a fly on the wall. But I wanted to tell you, I really always appreciated that and the way you treated me. This guy, we haven't met again till today. So I really appreciated that.
Well, that's a great story. Thank you very much. And I tried to do that with young people trying to get started in the business, because back when I started, I had a mentor named Earl Lawson, who is okay. Also in the Hall of Fame. He worked for the Cincinnati Post. And when I started covering the Reds, he took me aside and said, listen, kid, follow me around, keep your mouth shut, watch what I do, listen to what I do, and I'll help you out. And I did that. I followed him for quite a while, and I got to meet people like Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and people like that who would not have a time of day for me had it not been for Earl. So
right.
I remembered that, and I carried it on into my career to help as many people as I could.
Well, it was really neat. And actually, I got to see a side of Ken Griffey Jr. that you only kind of heard about. In that particular day, Jr. was trying to avoid going out to shag flies. And Senior kept telling him, get out there and catch some flies, get out in the outfield and do your warm up and all that. And Junior actually, he turned all the way around, went around the cages and back around on the other side of the infield. And here pretty soon Ken Griffey Senior yelled at him again and told him to get out there. And here was Ken Griffey Junior. He was already 30 years old, but he was still the kid in my eyes at that point. So that was a really neat day for me for sure.
Yeah, Ken Griffey Jr. is one of my all-time favorites and still remains one of my friends. He calls me every Christmas Eve to wish me a Merry Christmas. And as you probably know, I am legally blind.
Yes.
And the first time I went to spring training, every day, and Ken would take his batting practice, and I would watch. And my wife would always call. She was a school teacher. And at noon, she would call on her lunch break to see how I was doing. And the phone would always ring while I was by the batting cage. And Griffey was always there. And one day the phone rang. He grabbed the phone before I could answer it. He answered it and he said, Nadine, you can quit calling. We're taking care of him. He's fine.
Oh, that's great. That is great. We'll definitely get to that, because I know, as a reader of yours and even, the TV and radio stories that were done at the time about how Aaron Boone reached out. I'd like to talk about that a little bit later. I guess tell me a little bit about, as you mentioned, I've heard of the baseball beat writer's job, and kind of like you described, where you almost have to just listen and kind of you almost get a full education, don't you, from the manager? You were probably with Sparky every day before the game. And tell me about that. But then also tell me, if you could, tell me how did being a Reds beat writer evolve over the years? Because I'm sure it changed during the time you were there.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to get into the groundswell of the Big Red Machine. And being a beat writer, you go to the ballpark every day, get there 3 or 4 hours before game time, and you go into the manager's office and, you know, ask the questions that you need to know and ask about injuries and the lineup and things of that nature. And then you go watch batting practice. And I always did a notebook before the game in addition to a game story, and you gathered all your notes before the game. But I was fortunate to cover the Big Red Machine, and I thought, being a young kid then, that this is how it was going to be all the time. But I found out in 1982, when they lost 101 games, I got to see the other end of the spectrum. So, right. Yeah, it's it's a fun job, and I've done it for 50. This is my 51st year covering the Reds, and I always tell people I'm going to keep doing it until I get it right.
And there you go. What was it, I guess? And as you mentioned, you kind of had some good news to share, I guess, in those first several years. But besides talking about specific events that you remember well, did you ever have a time, especially in those early days, where maybe somebody got upset with you? Or I guess I know sometimes, and I guess also your paper was in Dayton, so maybe they didn't all read what you wrote as much. But what was that like on that end of it? You showed up every day, whether they were upset with you or not, right?
Oh, absolutely. That you had to do that. Plus the fact I was a beat writer, and I never missed a game. I didn't take any days off. I was afraid I might get Wally pipped. So I covered every game I could. And they did get to see what I wrote every day, because the publicity department would print out clippings of what you wrote, and they would be available in the clubhouse. So, yeah, they got to see what I saw. And I was very fortunate. Most of the time, if somebody had a beef with me, Johnny Bench was very good at that. He would be mad at me for a day and discuss it with me. Then he would be fine the next day. So that's all you can ask is, you show up and let them have their say and hope things are okay.
Well, and that's what I've always heard. And even I've covered a lot of high school sports over the years. And certainly we don't get too negative if we're writing about high school stuff. Right. But you still, if you write something that maybe, you know, is at all negative, whether it just be because of the wins and losses didn't go the school's way, you know, you've got to be there the next time so they see you. And if they have a beef with you, they can, you hear them out, I guess. And maybe you can explain yourself a little bit, but then at the end of the day, hopefully you walk away still on speaking terms.
Right, right. Most of the time, the professional baseball players, as long as you don't get personal in your criticism, they're fine with it. So they appreciate the fact that you just don't get personal.
Sure, sure. Well, tell me a little bit about those first couple of years. I was born in 79, so my only reference for this is reading about these events. But talk a little bit about maybe that first year you got to cover the playoffs when Pete Rose and Buddy Harrelson got in the big brawl. I don't know, were you in New York for that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, all the years I covered the Reds, I was at all the games home and away, and covered all the playoffs and the World Series. Covered the playoffs and World Series even if the Reds weren't in it. But in 73, okay. They were in it, and I was in New York, and the Mets upset the Reds. The Reds were supposed to win that series, but they didn't, and Pete Rose slid hard into second base, and knocked down Buddy Harrelson, who was a kind of a skinny guy, but he jumped up, and the fight was on, and the Shea Stadium fans went crazy, and towards the end of the game, they had to escort some of the Reds family and front office people off the field before the game ended, because they were afraid something might happen.
Well, that seems like a very highly charged situation. And I guess, what was it like? And of course, a few years earlier, they had been to the World Series. And then now you fast forward a little bit, let's go to 75. And it's like, Obviously, Game 6 is what everybody talks about. I love when Johnny Bench talks about it and says everybody else thinks the Red Sox won the World Series after Game 6. As a beat writer covering that, was it really tense around the clubhouse and with Sparky, given the fact that they really felt like they probably should have won already at that point?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think Johnny Bench stole that from me, because I've said that for years. Every time I give a speech, I say that probably Game 6 of the 75 World Series was the best game I ever covered.
Okay. And,
I've covered about 7,000 games in my career. Yeah, that was very, very special. And, geez, what a World Series that was. No, the Reds were pretty confident in themselves. And even after Game 6, I know Bench and Rose and Morgan were very confident they were going to win Game 7. And after Game 6, there wasn't a lot of gloom and doom in the clubhouse. They were very confident. And I think Bench even told Sparky to relax. We're going to win it for you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Tony Perez said the same thing.
Let me ask you this. The year after you started as a beat writer, Marty Brenneman came on as the play-by-play man. I presume you're somewhere similar in age. And Marty talks, and then Marty's a little different. He's more of a team employee, that kind of thing. Right. You were a journalist through and through. What was it like for you being around the same age or just a little bit older than some of these players? Was there a social aspect to it back then at all? Or was it just you were in the clubhouse and then you did your job?
No, absolutely. When I started in 73, I was, about the same age, a little bit older than most of the players. And traveling with him, at that time, the Reds flew a charter airplane and the beat writers got to go with them, rode the team bus back and forth to the ballpark and all that. So really got to know the players very well and became pretty good friends with a lot of them. I know you... being a professional, you're not supposed to get close to the players, but that's difficult to do when you're with them every day. Right. You're with them more than you are with your family, and you get to know them and become friends with a lot of them. But being a professional, if the time comes that you have to criticize them and point out mistakes, you got to do it. And most of them understood that. So it was pretty much being a really close part of the party.
Who were a few of the players there in those mid-70s that maybe you were really close to?
Pete Rose, of course. He was friends with everybody. And pretty much all of them. Don Gullett became a very, very good friend of mine. And still lamenting the recent passing of Don, who was such a great, great, great guy. But, most of them pretty friendly with, didn't have any problems with them.
That's awesome. That's really good. And I've heard the same about NBA teams and even NFL teams, the coverage back then, that's just the way it was. There weren't nearly as many barriers, I guess, to, and sure. I mean, they were famous and maybe you weren't famous, but at the same time, the vast difference now and what they make money wise and that sort of thing. And just the way that things have evolved, it is a lot different. You mentioned the 82 season. Actually, before we get to there, I wanted to ask you about what it was like to cover free agency when it first started, because from what I read, it just doesn't seem like people either understood what it exactly meant or what it was like. Can you share a little bit about what it was like when free agency came along?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. When it came along, I was kind of perplexed about how this was going to work and what was going to happen. And then the Reds lost Ken Griffey Sr. and they lost Don Gullett to free agency. Mm-hmm. And it was most of the media was dead set against it, thinking it was going to ruin the game. And it really probably hasn't helped, but it sure has helped the players. The immense salaries that they're getting now that they didn't get before free agency. Favored. Didn't help us any, but just made our job a little tougher.
Well, yeah, you needed a program all of a sudden.
Yes, absolutely.
A scorecard to tell who they were. Yeah, you're right about that. The answer is it changed, right? I mean, baseball had been around over 100 years to this point, and it certainly made it way different that people could actually leave their team on their own choosing without being cut or traded.
Yeah, back when I was a kid, back in the old ages, you got to know your team and it's pretty much stick together. It had the same players at the same team year after year after year, and you got to know who your team was. But now that free agency has come around, it changes and evolves so much that you can't tell your own team without a scorecard.
Well, and I know we're going to get to what you're doing now. You're covering a little University of Dayton basketball. College basketball is dealing with that right now. I mean, these teams are completely different year to year, and it's making it sometimes harder to watch if you're a fan, because it used to be you got to know those players for 3 or 4 years. Before we get past that 1982 mark, the best record in baseball season there in 81, take me through what it was like to kind of be around that. And was it an eye roll situation when you see them come out with a banner, or was it kind of like, no, they deserved it? They should have been in the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely. They had a baseball strike that interrupted the season, and then they came back and they divided the season into two parts. And they decided that the winner of the first part before the strike would make the playoffs, and the winner of the second part would make the playoffs. Well, as it turned out, the Reds had the best record if you combine the two halves of the season, but they did not win either half.
Yeah.
So they didn't make the playoffs. And I'll never forget when they came back after the strike, the Reds trained in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the University of Michigan. And it was announced how they were going to do the playoffs. And I was in the lobby with John McNamara, the manager. And he found out about it at that time. He destroyed the lobby of that hotel. He knocked over a potted plant. He took all the brochures and threw them around the room. He had his Irish dander up, and I don't blame him.
Well, no, I mean, it certainly doesn't sound good as far as if you're a Reds fan or if you – I mean, they put their heart and soul into it, and it was their livelihood, right? I mean, he would be remembered whether he – you know, if he had made the playoffs or not. That would have been a notch in his belt in his career.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the Reds had the best record in baseball, not just in the National
League. Right.
They were 66-41 or something like that. And mm-hmm. And not make it, then you know, that would have, you're right. McNamara would have been well, more well known than he was.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. We mentioned how guys left, and then, but actually, Pete Rose, he left and came back. Marge went and got him back. You know, most anybody who's a Reds fan, especially, I mean, that was about the time I started paying attention. But people know about the hit. But what was it like to cover that? I had Steve Fizziok on a previous episode, and he talked about, actually, he got married, but WLWT told him he couldn't go on his honeymoon until after Pete got the hit. So that was a funny story to me. But what was it like from your perspective to cover it?
Oh, it was fantastic because of Pete's personality and the way that he handled the media. They had press conferences all along the way as he got closer and closer to Ty Cobb. And it just absolutely amazed me that every press conference he would come up with a different story, and they would be great stories. And he really embraced it and made the job of the media very, very easy. It was just a fun thing to watch him accomplish what he did.
When you mentioned that, because I remember when McGuire and Sosa had the big home run chase in 98, and McGuire was so reluctant to be in the spotlight, so to speak. And I remember they eventually, he did those press conferences, but I don't know that he was like Pete in that way.
No, not even close. When the Reds played the Cardinals, they would bring him in for those interviews, and it would be yes and no and yes yeah. and no, and that's about it. But Pete would go on and on and on, and it was great.
If you were to use some of your words that you put together from the English language as a writer, how would you describe Pete? Because certainly for a later generations, it's basically not the most positive because of the things that have happened.
Right.
But in the moment through the 70s and then up to this hit chase, what was it like for you to deal with them? And then, like I said, can you try to describe them a little bit?
Oh man, that's very tough. If whoever invented baseball, Abner Doubleday or Andrew Cartwright or Tony La Russa or whoever it was, the game was designed for Pete Rose. I mean, every facet of the game you know, the way he played the game, he was just an unbelievable performer, and just embraced the game so much that it's really hard to put any kind of words other than he was just such a great ball player and such a great hitter, and it was his entire life. I mean, it was like he said he would go, he would walk through hell in a gasoline suit to play baseball.
And that's right.
That describes him perfectly, because he probably would.
And he's just, he must have been so confident too, right? I mean,
confident, you might even say cocky, but he backed it up. But you know, he would talk about how good he is, but he was, and he could hit. And I know I heard him talking not long ago, and somebody asked him about who were the good pitchers he hit against, and he mentioned that he owned Warren Spahn, and he said he could hit Don Sutton and Bob Welch blindfolded. So that's the way, how confident he was.
Yeah, and I tell you, being the age that I am, I remember at the turn of the century that ESPN did they did what they called the Sports Century Series. Mm-hmm. And they counted down the athletes. And then there's been other documentary type things about Pete and other athletes. But my thing was always, they would always give 45 to 60% of the show would be devoted to the gambling and the banishment from baseball and that sort of thing. And certainly that's part of what you have to talk about when you talk about Pete. But as someone who was younger, and I barely remember. He was a player manager in 86 and didn't play that often.
No.
I barely remember him playing at all. And all I had was my grandfather's Charlie Hustle book, the copy of the book that was written about him, and things like that to read about him. And I always lamented that, boy, this whole thing that has happened post-baseball playing career, we can't get the full story on him as a player, because they have to fast forward to the banishment for gambling and all the other things.
Yeah, most of the people nowadays involved in baseball are like you. They didn't get to see Pete play. I mean, I'm 83 years old, and I got to see his entire career almost. And to me, that's what I remember. I remember how great he was on the field and how great he was to the media. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I had to be part of the investigation and write all the stuff about him. And that was very, very tough for me to do. But it was part of my job. And but I still remember Pete for what he did on the field, and I'll never forget the day he reached 4192 off of Eric Shaw with a single, and how Riverfront Stadium just went absolutely bonkers. And Cincinnati fans still love the guy no matter what.
They do, they do. And I was talking to somebody recently, and every once in a while, a guy, even I remember when Chris Steins came up, and there's certain guys that they're not going to be Pete Rose's as far as accomplishments, but that guy that just hustles after every play and every ball and every, once every base they can get, Cincinnati really embraces that kind of play, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Chris Steins, and Chris Sabo was the same way. And if you ask those two guys who their baseball hero was, they're going to tell you it was Pete Rose. And that's who they tried to emulate and play like. And
no doubt,
he
no
said
doubt
they didn't it. Have they didn't have the hitting prowess that Pete did, but they had the hustle that he had.
Sure. Now, you mentioned having to cover the story, and that came in 1989. If you want to share anything about that coverage, that'd be great. But then also, let's transition then to the following year, because they were kind of in no man's land. There was another play stoppage of play before spring training could get going, and then all of a sudden they had this new manager, and they went on a great streak and 9-0, and they went wire to wire.
Well, going back to 1989, that was the toughest year of my career, because I had to cover every game. Mm-hmm. Then I had to for people at the paper doing investigative work, but I was the front guy. Mm-hmm. And I had to go face him and ask him the tough questions every day. And after Pete got banned, it was kind of like kill the messenger. You know, I was the guy who was asking him all the questions and writing the stories. So he didn't speak to me for like 15 years.
Oh, man.
And, you know, we had been very close. So that was tough. So about 15 years later, my wife and I went to Las Vegas. And Pete was there in a memorabilia shop signing autographs. And my wife said, "There's Pete Rose. Go in and say hello." And I said, "You want to start a riot?" And she said, "You go in there and say hello." And I said, "I can't do that. He hates my guts." So she pushed me in the door, and Pete saw me, and he jumped up, shook my hand, had me sit down next to him, had a photographer there, took our picture together, had the picture developed right then, put it in a leather case, and he signed it to a great Hall of Famer from the hit King, Pete Rose. So made up that day, and now we still talk, and I have his personal phone number, and I was so happy. So I was glad that my wife was insistent.
Yeah, sometimes the wife knows best, doesn't she?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about 1990. That group before 89, with all the turmoil and all the stuff that happened in 89, and even some injuries, they kind of hit a stall at that point. But the four or so years before then, Pete had led them to a second place finish every year.
Right.
So those young guys, Barry Larkin, Eric Davis, Paul O'Neill, Chris Sabo, Tom Browning, Jose Rio had come over, and then, of course, the Nasty Boys. That group certainly was primed and ready to go, weren't they?
Yeah, no doubt about it, although people didn't realize it, and I don't think manager Lou Pinella, although he told the team in spring training they were going to win it. I don't know if he believed that or not, or he's just trying to inspire them, but I'll never forget the only time a manager ever asked my advice. He called me into his office in spring training before the 90 season. He said, "Hal, you've been around this team forever. What does this team need?" And I, off the top of my head, I said, "It needs a leadoff hitter." So he installed Barry Larkin as the leadoff hitter. And after they won it, he called me aside then. He said, "Hal, you're absolutely right. Thank you." That's the first and last time a manager ever asked me my advice. So
did you get a ring?
I'm batting 1,000.
Did you get a ring? Did they help you out?
I actually back in 75 and 76, I did get World Series.
Wow.
They gave them to the media back then, but things changed. And in 1990, of course, Marge Schott wasn't about to give us anything.
Not at all. No. Well, and Mary Larkin could have batted first, second, or third. I mean, he was such a hybrid there with his ability to,
right,
to get on base, but hit for power if he needed to, and then steal some bases as well. So
he did bat third some that year, but most of the time he batted leadoff because that's what the team needed, and he did it right.
Hey, one question as I back up just a moment. I've tried to research this myself. Do you recall the circumstances? Because now if you trade a guy who's making a little bit more money for maybe a minor leaguer or a first or second year player, you can see that on the ledger sheet. And you kind of understand it. What was the reasoning behind trading John Franco for Randy Myers?
That is a very good question. I've never come up with an answer to that one either. It looked bad at the time, but John Franco was absolutely lights out.
Yeah.
He was a great, great closer. And, he was a good citizen. There was nothing that happened in the clubhouse, or he didn't say anything against the front office. He was a great teammate. And then they traded him for crazy man Randy Myers.
Well, and you think about it, I think John might have been making a little bit more money, but they're both lefties. And it was almost trading for the same, not the same person, certainly, as you've already mentioned. Randy Myers, the talk of all the grenades and the knives and the different things in the clubhouse, certainly he had a little bit different aura about him. Of course, Franco got to go home to New York, so I don't know if that was part of it or not, but I wouldn't think they would make that trade just to help John out, you know?
No, not when they were, putting together the team that they were putting together. I thought that he would be a big part of it, so do not know why that happened.
Okay, well, you're as good as anybody to ask, so I'm glad that I'm just not missing something when I've tried to research it online and things like that. Who called them the Nasty Boys first? Was that you?
No, that was not me. That was I think that came among themselves.
Okay.
But I think Randy Myers said, we're just nasty, and it stuck.
Sure did. And certainly, I guess, I don't know if it would have been much different with Franco in the mix instead of him, but it did seem like they were such a unit, the three of them. And I know Norm Charlton started some games that year because of injury.
Right.
But my goodness. And then you talk about, you know, I think the Royals in 2015 and some of these other teams that have gone on to do really well, even the 96 Yankees with Wetland and Rivera. I mean, you go back to that Reds bullpen and they really kind of set a tone for, you know, sixth inning and on, we've got this game.
Exactly right. Then it didn't matter which one. I mean, they all three were interchangeable. All three of them could close. All three of them could come in the seventh inning or eighth inning. Whatever the situation was, that you know, Lou saw the matchups. They had any of those three could do the job, and they did it.
I have a memory of being out in my dad's garage in the garage where I grew up, and it's the ninth inning. The transistor radio's on, and Myers, it's a one-run lead or something like that, and he walks the bases loaded, or he gets second and third and nobody out or something like that. And I'll never forget Marty Brenneman calling him a thrill a minute. He said he was a thrill a minute.
Yeah, all three of those guys were certifiably nuts. And believe it or not, I think Norm Charlton was the worst, and he was the smartest, and he had a triple major out of Rice University, but he was the instigator. He would start the trouble, and then Myers and Dibble would be the ones that would get in trouble.
My dad took me over. My mom and dad took me over to Athens, Ohio, at one point, probably. I don't know if it would have been between the 90 and 91 seasons or when it would have been, but Rob Dibble was there signing autographs at like a card show. And I waited in line, and it was he and his agent, I assume, the guy with them. And he kept asking every kid after they'd already gotten there, "Hey, what's your name?" And then he'd write their name. And I must have thought, well, I'll get it out of the way right away, and that way we can chat for a second. And I said, "Seth, I'm Seth." And I slid the card over, and he looked at his agent, and they just laughed at me. And I was only like 11 years old, and I remember being sad about that. But then, you know, now it doesn't matter that much. But I still remember, here he was. I mean, he was a big guy too for me being a little kid. So,
Of course, you remember the Rob Dibble and Lou Piniella fight?
Yes, yes.
I started that.
Okay, tell me about it.
One night, Dibble didn't pitch when the situation would have called. To use Dibble tonight, and he said, well, before the game, Rob told me he had a little twinge in his elbow, so I didn't use him. Mm-hmm. So I went out to Dibble and I said, what's wrong with your elbow? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, your manager just told me that you didn't pitch tonight because you had a twinge in your elbow. And Dibble said, well, the manager's a liar. So I went back to Lou and I said, one of your pitchers just called you a liar. And Lou jumped out of his chair and ran into the clubhouse, jumped on Dibble, and the fight was on, and I had a great story.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a great story. I remember a war of words kind of where the reporters went back and forth a little bit when Dave Stewart was the pitching coach for the Brewers, and Joe Nuxall said that they brought in this rookie to throw at somebody. Yeah. And the word got to Dave Stewart that Nuxall had said that, and they went, the reporters, maybe you, went back and forth. And Nuxall said, well, you hit Billy Hatcher on purpose in the 90 World Series, and you hit him on purpose, too. So, yeah, absolutely. The guy was batting 750. You don't want him in the lineup anymore, being Billy Hatcher. You know, not long after that season, a year or two later, Jim Bowden took over as general manager, and he was there for pretty much a decade, I guess. And certainly – I always remember, you know, Peter Gammons would always have these scoops about the Reds, and you think, well, how's he getting that? And here Jim Bowden would kind of tell him things, apparently. Yeah. I asked you that to say this, like, can you talk about covering Jim Bowden? Because certainly he was more in front of the camera than a lot of general managers are. But then also, what is it like as a beat writer who's there every day watching news filtered out to these national people? I know, being around Ohio State athletics, that gets bothersome sometimes when the national guy gets the scoop and, hey, we're here every day.
Yeah, exactly right. But, you know, they figure if they hit the national rather than just, you know, the local newspapers and the local radio TV stations. And it can get annoying. And I know that Bowden loved Peter Gammons, but yeah. I didn't get scooped too many times. Bowden would whisper a few things in my ear once in a while, but we had a little bit of a contentious relationship once in a while. I know he got mad at me one time, and he went into the clubhouse and he told the players not to talk to me.
Oh, man.
Well, I walked into the clubhouse and seven or eight players couldn't wait to tell me what Bowden said. So I went up to the dining room and Bowden was there. And I said, so you told the players not to talk to me, huh? And he said, no, I did not. And I said, well, then about six of your players are liars. And,
yeah.
He walked away. And we had our times together.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever think, I remember in 02, the story was that he had trades in place for both Scott Rolen and Bartolo Colon, and then ownership wouldn't approve the money and things like that. Did you ever think that because he was so out in front that he got a bad name because of the fact that he was kind of the face of it all, but it was really the fact that ownership wouldn't pay for the players sometimes that it might have required?
Yeah, absolutely. He did a pretty good job of bringing in players reclamation projects because mm-hmm. of the fact that ownership wouldn't pay the money. He managed to go out and bring in some pretty good pitchers that served him well for a year or two, like Pete Harnish and
Pete Shurick.
Shurick, yep, absolutely, yep.
And I saw the other day when Don Gullett did pass away that Bowden put out a tweet about the fact that he was a great man, but also, that he would take these reclamation projects that Bowden would hand him, and Gullett, he really credited Gullett with turning those guys around or helping them get there. So let's go ahead and move along then. That improbable 1999 season. I know, again, it's partially my age. I mean, I was at the 1995 NLCS as a fan, as a high school student. 1990, I always remember, but I was only 11. But that 1999 season, being a college student at Ohio State, having a roommate whose family had season tickets, and just getting down I-71 as much as possible to watch that team play, that's, for now anyway, the favorite team I ever was following day to day.
Yeah. Sean Casey and those guys, and it went right down to the final day of the season. We were in Milwaukee, and they had to win that game to set up the playoff with the Mets on Monday. But on the Sunday, and it rained all day. Yeah. It took us 7 hours to get that game in, and I think I set a record for consuming Milwaukee bratwurst in the press box. They won that game, and unfortunately, they used up all their pitching, and they didn't have any pitching, and they got shut out 5-0 by Al Leiter, I believe it was.
It was.
Yeah. So that was a big disappointment, but that was a very, very fun season, 1999. Good team.
I asked if you coined the phrase "Nasty Boys." You did coin the phrase "the Big Road Machine." They won 52 games that year on the road.
52 games on the road, and I did call them the Big Road Machine. Absolutely.
That was a fun year. And I talked to Eddie Tobensee a few weeks ago, and Eddie Tobensee lamented the fact that obviously Sean Casey was stuck on 99 RBI. And they thought, even against a lefty like Al Leiter, I know he was hopeful with that extra game to maybe get over that 100 mark. And certainly that would have been secondary to winning the game. But
yeah, that would have been nice. It's always nice to have that 100 on your. Yeah. Your resume rather than 99. It's only 100 more RBI, but it makes
I know difference. It makes a difference. Those round numbers. Okay, I guess before I ask you about when your eyesight took a turn for the worse, can you look back from your whole career? Is there a moment or a season or a game that you remember most fondly?
Well, we already talked about Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. That so many. Tom Browning's perfect game, two no-hitters by Homer Bailey. Of course, Pete Rose, 4-1-9-2. Just hard to point to one because there were so doggone many, and I've been so fortunate to be able to witness all of that. I've done it, covered baseball for 52 years. I've been in journalism for 63, but I always told my wife that someday I'm going to have to get a real job, but I never did.
Well, you make that point, and it's been, I guess, 22 years ago now that you did have situation with your eyesight to where you couldn't see nearly as well, and you basically said you might just have to quit then, and then Aaron Boone was one of the guys that I know talked you out of it.
Absolutely. happened in 2002. We were in St. Louis, and it was the last day of a road trip, and I felt a little something in my right eye. And, you know, I thought you could wipe it out like you do when you feel something in your eye, but it didn't go away. So I got home, and it was still there. So my wife took me to the eye doctor, who is usually he's a big baseball fan, and he would always talk to me about baseball, and we would laugh and have a good time. Well, he examined my eye, and he got real quiet. So I knew something was wrong. And he said, I got good news and bad news. I said, well, what's the bad news? So the bad news, you've had a stroke of your optic nerve, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no cure, no treatment. You just have to hope it doesn't get any worse. And I said, well, what's the good news? It only happens in both eyes to 15% of the people. And I said, well, that's pretty good odds. And My left eye took over. I didn't really realize I couldn't see much out of my right eye. I still played tennis every day and drove a car. But about a year later, just before spring training, I got up one morning and I said to my wife, well, we've just become the big 15%er. I can't see. Everything's dark and fuzzy. And so I told my sports editor, Frank Corso is his name, that I was going to have to quit. That I can't see, I can't cover baseball anymore. So he said, you're going to go to spring training and give it a try. And I said, well, okay. So I went to spring training, and I took my bags to the condo where I was going to stay. And I said, well, let's get this over. Took a cab to the ballpark, and I walked into Ed Smith Stadium in Sarasota, Florida. I walked into the clubhouse, stood by the door, and I looked around in the clubhouse, and everything was dark and fuzzy, and I couldn't make out faces of the players that I've known for years. And Aaron Boone was a third baseman for the Reds at the time, and I guess he saw my consternation and got up and came over and said, what's wrong with you? And I said, I told him what had happened. I said, you're probably seeing me for the last time. I can't do this. Well, he grabbed me by the arm and said, you go sit down. So I went and sat down at his locker, and he said, I don't ever want to hear you say the word quit again. You're too good at your job. Every guy in his clubhouse will help you out. And he turned me around that day. I would have quit, but I kept going, and I'm still doing it. And of course, Aaron made me pay. He told people that he would catch me talking to a Coke machine. Probably right. But anyway, you know, Hall of Fame votes are sacred, and I don't get frivolous with mine. But when Aaron Boone's name was on the ballot, he got one vote. And you know who that was.
Absolutely, for good reason.
He is a Hall of Fame person.
Now, again, we talked earlier about how in the 70s, with you being around their same age and things just being different, that you would be more friendly or be with them maybe after games and things like that. By 2002 and 3, you were not. This is a different era, and here's Aaron Boone, who famously, you know, his father would lose his job, and then he would be traded in the summer of 2003. But here he was stepping up to help you, and certainly that meant probably a lot more than if he was, you know, if you guys were best friends or something like that, obviously.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, all I did was cover him. Back in the 70s, the clubhouse was open. You could go in there anytime and talk to the players at any time. And as I said, you travel with them and things of that nature. But by that time, you got about an hour in the clubhouse before the game, and then you had to get out. You couldn't get in there until they let you in, and you didn't travel with the team. So the only time you saw them was when they played the game, and about an hour before and a half an hour after the game. So you didn't really create close relationships. So For him to do that, that meant a whole lot, yes.
I will tell you, I was just reminded that day I told you about in the year 2000 that I came to Cleveland to cover the game. The Reds won that game in extra innings. Griffey hit a double off the wall to tie it, and Boone either hit a home run or a triple or something like that to knock in the winning run. And then, of course, they closed it out. And I went into the Reds clubhouse in the post game. And the interesting thing was, and this is 2000, this wasn't further along, but people would try to go up to Ken Griffey Jr. and talk to him. And it was getaway day. It was Sunday. And he said, no, I don't want to talk. But you came in and you walked up to him and he stood up and then we all whooshed in. He was willing to talk to you. He knew you from growing up, I'm sure. But that was the kind of respect he had for you, because he had kind of swatted away the other folks. And this was a game that they had won and he had had a big hand in winning.
Well, I was very close to his father, of course. Ken Griffey and George Foster were bosom buddies, and I got to know them very well, and they both trusted me a lot. And now I remember that the night that they had the press interview when Ken Griffey Jr. was traded to the Reds, we were in the room doing the interview, and I raised my hand, and before he could say anything, he looked at me and he said, "I trust you because my father said you're all right." So. That helped a lot.
That sure did. That sure did. And that certainly, it was evidence there as I guess a 21 or 2 year old guy, not even in the business yet. So that was definitely, I knew he had reverence for you. So that was really neat. Well, yeah. Okay. So now, I know you are writing for Press Pros Magazine and you're covering the University of Dayton men's basketball. Tell me a little bit about that and kind of getting back not just covering Reds baseball anymore. You're doing a little bit of college basketball as well.
Yeah, that's probably heresy to say, but I really, really enjoy covering college basketball and those kids. Well, first of all, before I covered the Reds, when I mentioned everything that I covered before, my beat before I covered the Reds was the University of Dayton basketball back in the late. And covered some good University of Dayton teams at that time. But now that I'm getting back in it and covering all the home games and the awesomeness of the UD arena and the fans and 13,400 people every night. And this team is really, really good. They're 21-4. And what I like most about this team is the kids are all so good, so great. Mm-hmm. They are so polite, nice kids. It's yes, sir, no, sir, thank you, sir, every one of them. Which I guess goes back to Coach Anthony Grant right. And the type of players that he recruits. But I just enjoy covering college basketball so much. I played basketball in high school in addition to baseball, and I love the sport.
It is a good sport. I'm still a Buckeye, so we're having a bit of a topsy-turvy season so far with the firing of a coach and that sort of thing. But Sunday was good. They beat Purdue, so that was neat.
Awesome game.
That was a good game. Well, Hal, thanks so much for all your time today. I really appreciate it. I thank you so much for what you've done. I mean, again, when I was in college, it was the first time I was, late 90s. It was the first time I was able to be online every day or whatever. And I had multiple stops every morning when I got up. The Dayton Daily News website, the Inquirer website, and then later on in the day, the Cincinnati Post website. And you were the first one I read every day. So I really appreciate all you did for Reds fans everywhere and the coverage you gave us all.
Well, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. And thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks so much. We're going to get out of here on that. And thanks for tuning in to Red Leg Roundtable.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unified, UNIFYD healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.